This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and I am so excited to have on the show today Beth Dooley. She is the author or co-author of several cookbooks, including one of my absolute favorites, The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, which won a James Beard Award, by the way. She is also author or co-author of The Birchwood Cafe Cookbook, The Northern Heartland Kitchen, and Savory Sweet, Simple Preserves from a Northern Kitchen. And now out with a new cookbook, The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. Beth, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Thank you for calling in.
It is a beautiful cookbook that has a lot of great recipes, but I want to focus in right away on that subtitle, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. It's easy to think healthy cookbook. Okay, you're talking about us having, you know, good, healthy food and digestive systems and for our bodies. But I think it's fair to say that when you are talking about healthy future, you're looking at a much bigger picture.
Yes, thank you so much for calling that out, because the book really is trying to link us home cooks with the work being done in regenerative agriculture, which is sustainable agriculture. I mean, it embraces that term, but it takes it one step further to look at ways of growing food that actually improve the land and help address some of the issues that we're seeing as a result of industrial agriculture, industrial foods, where we're using a lot of chemicals and we're growing monocrops, meaning corn and soy in rotation, which are annual, summer annual crops, leaving the land bare so that the topsoil runs off into the Mississippi River, and topsoil is critical to growing good food. And, you know, we're not providing the habitat that shelters pollinators and wildlife that we need so badly. So there are a lot of things that can be done by changing the way we grow food, keeping continuous cover on the land with perennial crops such as hazelnuts and kernza, which is a relatively new grain in market. It's a perennial intermediate wheatgrass that produces that seed head like wheat that can be milled or cooked like a whole grain, as well as many of the artisan grains, barley and oats and rye and teff and, you know, a number of the different small grains that are delicious and that keep continuous cover on the land. So that's part of what this cookbook is trying to do, is to reach home cooks and make them aware of these foods that are so delicious, but they're also beneficial not only for our health, but for the health of the land and the environment, as well as many of our rural economies that are looking for ways to solve some of the issues they're suffering from industrial ag.
So why the focus on home cooks? Why not go after places like Costco and say you should be stocking kernza?
Because Costco isn't going to stock kernza unless people buy it. And so, you know, it's to raise awareness around these foods so that people know to ask for them when they go to Costco or to their co-ops or to their local grocery store, so that they're aware of them and our farmers know that there's a market for them and they'll be what we're all part of the same food chain, right? I think we cooks forget when we go to the market that we're part of a much bigger system and that we have a role to play in it. And I find that really exciting because I'm not a farmer, and yet I greatly admire the farmers that are doing this kind of work and growing our food. And it's, you know, to me, I want to partner with them in this work.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if someone is growing the kernza and then gives it to me, I guess now I have a copy of The Perennial Kitchen. But before this, I don't have a cookbook that has anything
exactly
to do with kernza. I don't even really have a good sense of what it is.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So how did you end up developing the recipes for some of these foods that are less common in our cookbooks?
Right. It was a really fun challenge. What I wanted to do was to keep the recipes really simple, because, you know, they are relatively unfamiliar foods. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to show people how to use them in ways that were familiar. that were simple and familiar. And that way, too, you can taste how good they are. If you're mucking something up with a lot of sauces or a lot of different, salts and peppers and herbs and things like that, you're not going to taste the flavor of these different foods. And so I wanted people to be able to appreciate the difference in flavor as well as not be afraid to try something new. And if you're using, for instance, oat groats, which are really whole grain oats, in a risotto, which is familiar to most people, but mm-hmm. usually we use arborio rice, which comes in from Italy, for instance, or from California, why not try making it with local oat groats? Because you can make a delicious, creamy risotto with this wonderful local grain that has a terrific sort of nutty flavor to it, and you can end up with a beautiful risotto. Mm. So it's a way to sort of showcase the flavor and the versatility of these foods for people that are not familiar with them and don't know what to do with them without going, ooh, that sounds too weird, I'm not going to try that.
What about, ooh, that sounds too hard?
These are really easy, and that was the point of the book, was to keep things super simple, because I don't know about you, but given COVID, I'm kind of tired of cooking night after night. And so, I'm always looking for something that's simple and quick, but really tasty. So the idea, too, as I was developing the recipes, was to keep things really simple, not use tons of different ingredients, not use ingredients that are hard to find. Everything in this book should be familiar, and all of the ingredients should be super easy to find, and the recipes come together quickly, but I also wanted to use bold flavors, so you'll get a lot of bang for the buck without having to muss around too much.
A minute ago, you said using local, for example, instead of using a rice from Italy or what have you for a risotto. The definition of the word local, does that mean it has to be within 5-10 minutes of my house, something I can bike to?
Great question. I love that question. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but no. I mean, the whole idea is changing the notion of food so that we're really working within what we call a food shed, which is like a watershed. It's like, let's look at areas that grow different foods the best, because apples don't grow really well in different parts of our region, for instance, but they grow great up along the North Shore where there's a microclimate. They grow pretty well down in different pockets of our state that have super even temperatures, right? So let's grow lots of apples there, and then let's think about growing the grains in areas that where we're growing a lot of corn and soy, where grains have, the potential to begin replacing some of those big monocrops, because you need large tracts of land to grow these kinds of grains. So by incorporating them into a corn-soy rotation, for instance, we can grow lots of those grains for people like me that will use them. But that doesn't mean that every farm has to have grains. So I guess. By local, I meant really a regional food shed. I meant in a terroir that we're familiar with, because I think part of the beauty of places like Italy, for instance, or France, is that each of those regions does something very well, and those regions, trade with each other. So in France, where they have beautiful buckwheat, for instance, and they grow a lot of it in the northern areas of France, that buckwheat gets exchanged with wheat that's grown in the southern part of the state. It doesn't mean that you don't use it. It just means that you value what comes out of different growing areas within a specific region. And that way, maybe you lose the efficiency of growing tons of food in one area in California, which exhausts the soil and puts, a lot of pressure on the land and the water out there, ship it to our area, when instead you could grow some of those crops in rotation in our region in ways that paid attention to what grows best in different areas, if that makes sense.
We're visiting with Beth Dooley, the author of the new cookbook, The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. Beth, what do cover crops really do?
That's a great question. They return nutrients to the soil that have been extracted by growing other crops. And so basically, they also, their main value is that they hold down the topsoil, which when you leave soil uncovered, when you leave the ground uncovered, blows away. I mean, think about it. You wouldn't dig up your lawn every season just because winter was coming and the grass goes dormant, right? And then plant a new crop of grass in the spring. Because if you did that, all of your soil on your front lawn would run into the sewer. So the idea is to plant cover crops because they will die back and whatever matter is left nourishes the soil. You can plant in that. They also return nutrients to soil because when you plant crops with an idea of plants that extract a certain kind of nutrient and then you follow with a plant that returns that nutrient to the soil, you're planting them in rotation, for instance. And the other thing is that, you know, the more cover we have on the land, the more carbon we can drive out of the atmosphere back into the soil where it belongs. And that is another way to help mitigate climate change. So we need to keep continuous cover on the land to address many of the problems that we're seeing with our water, our air, and our topsoil.
Are you seeing trends with some of the bigger food producers out there going in this direction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, General Mills has made a big investment in Kernza. Patagonia Provisions, mm-hmm. which is a large company in, you know, it's part of the Patagonia clothing company.
Yeah, their food's awesome.
Their food's great. Yeah, and they've invested in Kernza. They make a beer called Longroot Ale. And then a number of our smaller innovative companies, brewers like Bang Brewing in Minneapolis, which is a wonderful brewery that it's a microbrewery that was one of the first that was founded by a woman, is turning Kernza into terrific beer. There's another beer co-op in Minneapolis that was making a beer called North. That is a favorite of Will Steger, for instance, and the proceeds from the sales of the beer North were going to support Will's climate generation efforts. So there's a lot of interest both at the macro level among larger companies and smaller companies that are trying to find different ways to use these foods as an ingredient, and then also to share information about dealing with, you know, many of the environmental issues we're facing.
So you talked about the importance of this book being connecting the home cook to these ingredients that might not be as readily available. Where can we get them then?
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, in the book, there's a list of resources. So there are places where you can order many of these foods online. But many of them are also available in our co-ops, our local co-ops. So, and I know in your area, there's a big seed conference every year in Fargo, North Dakota, and North Dakota State is doing terrific work on breeding crops that are great for cover crops and then also are some of the perennials. Hazelnuts are one of the big crops that we're going to see more of, local hazelnuts. And there is the American Hazelnut Company, which is a co-op that's engaging farmers and has a processing plant in northern Wisconsin in Ashland, where they're toasting the nuts and pressing those nuts into a beautiful hazelnut oil and then grinding them into flour for a gluten-free flour. Now, that product is available in many of the co-ops within our region. And then you can find those products online. Kernza, both the flour and the grain, is available from the Perennial Pantry, which is a small mill in Minneapolis, one of the Minneapolis suburbs. So you can order that online. Bakersfield Flour and Bread, which is a milling company in Minneapolis, is milling heritage wheats and a couple of different grains like rye and corn that are coming in from local farms, and you can buy their product online. And I know that there are, I think it's Great River Milling in your area. There are a number of mills. There's Doubting Thomas Farms, which is a fabulous grower and mill. I think they're in Moorhead, either Moorhead or Fargo.
Yeah,
I can
Moorhead.
Send you. Yeah, Moorhead. And they're wonderful. They're terrific, and you can buy their products in stores or online. So the idea is just to make people aware of too, in the cookbook of where they can find some of these foods. They're not always available in the stores, but they are, many of them, available online. And I'm not expecting that people are only going to eat out of the region, but there is the economic equation that $1 spent on a local product, especially a local food product, returns $4 to the local economy. So if we just switched maybe even 5 to 10% of our food dollar towards some of these local foods, we would be making a terrific contribution to our local economy.
One thing that humans love to do is be a little over the top with things. There's nothing inherently wrong with growing corn, for example, especially when mm-hmm. it's done in that indigenous tradition, or at least indigenous to these parts in the Great Lakes area, of that Three mm-hmm. Sisters corn, squash, and beans. But as you said, it's the large-scale monocropping, growing only corn and over and over, where that gets to be problematic to the land. How do we make sure that, you know, now we don't just say, oh, Kernza, that's going to solve everything. Let's grow fields and fields and fields of Kernza repeatedly.
That's a great question. And I think one of the ways to address that, because that is a concern, is to understand that none of these crops really are targeted to become commodities. Because commodities are really grown with an eye to the most efficiency, and it's a race to the bottom. It's premised on the more you grow, the cheaper it will become.
Mm-hmm.
This is a completely different mindset that understands that there are values to doing things differently that are worth, as a society, are paying for and recognizing as benefits to us all. So rather than increase my taxes, for instance, to build another water purification plant, why wouldn't I want to shift some of those commodity dollars that are being underwritten by our tax base to support farmers that are using integrated practices to introduce crops that mitigate the problems caused by monocrops? So it's really a paradigm shift. It's looking at thinking about food differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's having an opportunity to value what goes into the growing of that food beyond just eating something that's cheap.
We're visiting with Beth Dooley, the author of The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. And Beth, going back to that for a healthy future, for a long time in the food world and among foodies, it was considered the only way to be really environmentally friendly as an eater is to be vegetarian, is to have a plant-based mm-hmm. diet. And there was a lot of research that came out about greenhouse gas emissions, for example, in raising livestock. The first picture in your book is pasture, and you have a section
yeah.
on pasture-raised cattle versus the kinds of animals that are more likely to end up in the grocery store, that big kind of
right.
factory farm approach.
Right, right. You know, again, the idea is, you understand that animals are incredibly beneficial to the land because they're herbivores. They live on grass, and we need more grass on the land. And we can't just grow grass. Nobody can afford to keep, you know, pasture after pasture just in grass, for instance, where grass grows really well. And so the animals provide a service for us, but then the animals have a life cycle. And so why not be humane in how we slaughter them and provide really clean protein for humans who have always eaten meat? And so, you know, I know that there are arguments that we can eat all plant-based foods. And I'm not arguing that everybody has to eat meat. What I'm saying is that when we raise these animals on grass, it's beneficial to the land. It's beneficial to the farmer who is able to make an income doing things that benefit the land, and it's good for us. I mean, grass-fed beef is one of the healthiest foods we can eat. It's far higher in omega-3s and in conjugated glycolic acid, CLA, which is really good for brain health, and it's very low in cholesterol. So it's a very healthy protein. It's expensive because raising meat this way is expensive, so you don't want to eat a whole lot of it. And I can tell you that a number of the butchers that I've met were small butchers that work only with grass-fed animals were once vegetarians because they believed that that was the most environmental and sustainable way to eat. And then they realized the benefits that pasture has to our land and how raising these animals differently is really quite humane. So I think part of it, too, is understanding that most Americans are not very comfortable embracing the cycle of life or taking responsibility for our eating decisions. And that is one way to do it, is to know the source of all your food. If you decide to not eat meat, that's fine. But also know that there are other sources that are super sustainable, really good for you and good for the planet. What's not good for the planet is these contained animal feeding operations, which are really difficult to manage. They're not very humane. You're compressing a lot of animals into a very, into very small space. Mm-hmm. The manure lagoons are difficult to manage. The aromas that waft forth from those factories are difficult to live nearby. I mean, there are just a lot of issues that surround that. And so there are different ways of doing things.
We had the executive director of Audubon Dakota on about a month ago, and he was talking about the bird-friendly certification for looking for meat. So that's kind of an easy one. What else can we look for? Because there's organic, and there's grass-fed, and there's grain-fed, and they don't all mean the same thing, and they're not necessarily all good.
That's exactly right. There is, there are people that like a grass-fed meat that's grain-finished, and that's fine because a little bit of grain is going to add more fat to that meat. The organic certification label is terrific for fruits and vegetables that come in from afar because you don't know how they're grown. And if you want to avoid the chemicals that are applied to those fruits and vegetables, that's one thing. If you know your farmer, it doesn't have to be organic because organic certification really is best applied to larger farms that are far away from us. But getting to know where things are coming from in a particular region can be really helpful to the eater in discerning what they want to buy. And so I guess I would argue, without getting too complicated, I would argue that grass-fed is usually the best choice. Because grass-fed or pasture-raised, you know that they're outside. With the organic certification, those animals could be eating grain in a contained feeding operation system. So it doesn't ensure that they're outside wandering around, which is what you want. Not only is that good for the animal, it's also good for the land. So I guess, in making those discernments, grass-fed or pasture-raised is usually the best choice.
Beth Dooley is the author of The Perennial Kitchen, Simple Recipes for a Healthy Future. She is also the author or co-author of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen and The Birchwood Cafe Cookbook and Savoring the Seasons of the Northern Heartland, among several others. Beth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. And please tell your listeners to check out my website and to contact me if they have questions or want to argue with me or have more looking for more information. Because basically, this whole book is supposed to be joyful and fun and just introduce people to some new foods and new flavors that they can goof around with in the kitchen.
Still to come on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith. But now it's time for the news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. The Bismarck-Mandan area has seen an increase in catalytic converter thefts. The thefts have happened on the streets as well as in car dealerships.
We just recently had several catalytic converters stolen from the Bilbar Ford Kia area.
Mandan Police Lieutenant Patrick Haug.
Obviously, the contents of catalytic converters, some of the minerals that are inside it are somewhat valuable, and people have realized, if we take them to the salvage yards, you know, they can make $200, $300, $400 in some cases.
Haug says several car shops will be holding catalytic converter engraving events.
What we're going to do is engrave the vehicle's VIN number onto the catalytic converters. And then I also believe they may spray some of the catalytic converters with a high heat paint to provide us a way of identification for these catalytic converters.
The shops are not charging for that service. North Dakota is still meeting its targets for capture of natural gas. The gas is produced by oil well drilling in the Bakken. But regulators say more investment in gas plants and other infrastructure will be necessary over the next few years to help meet those flaring goals.
Gas processing as a whole from a statewide, we are in a bit better position now for the next couple of years, but we're going to need some additional plants that have been planned to come online.
North Dakota Pipeline Authority Director Justin Kringsted says it could also put pressure on gas gathering pipelines.
Any growth, unexpected growth in gas oil ratios at any point along that gathering system will slowly start to overwhelm the system, and we'll see pressures build up and flares go back to the wellhead. So it's going to be a continual challenge to stay on top of the gathering systems.
As of April, North Dakota is capturing 93% of natural gas. North Dakota's Department of Transportation and Capital Electric Cooperative are hosting an electric vehicle tailgate party. It'll take place Thursday afternoon from 4 until 7 p.m. on the state capitol grounds, just west of the DOT building. The sponsors say the purpose is to raise awareness of electric vehicles. There are currently 266 electric vehicles registered in North Dakota, and the state has 78 charging stations. Vehicles range from passenger cars to SUVs, school buses, and motorcycles. Banyo says electric vehicles are considered an alternative form of transportation, but they could eventually become the new normal. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
They'll offer you hot tea at a public market in Turkey.
Every hour of the day, it is the beverage that we go for.
Get the scoop on running a tour business from Steve Perillo.
When I was young and single and a tour leader, I was a rock star.
And consider what being inclusive really means.
Show me people who look like me and I'll come there. I'll know that I'm welcome there.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now in studio is horticulturist Ron Smith. He joins us periodically during the growing season to talk about lawns and gardens. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ashley. Thank you.
You can always send a question to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And Ron, last time you were in, it was a lot of drought.
Yes.
Since then, we have had a couple of nice rains moving across much of the state.
Yep.
What is the impact on the drought conditions?
Well, it's still droughty. Mm-hmm. The forecasters, the long-range forecasters, are going to predict that it's going to be a hotter than normal and somewhat of a droughty summer throughout our region, our western Minnesota and most of North Dakota and some of South Dakota. So we need to be aware of that and make sure our plants are not suffering too much. Now, that rainfall that came was really both a blessing and a curse somewhat. The blessing was it got some water into the soil profile, not just got the top half inch or so wet, but it also flooded because the soil couldn't take the water in fast enough, and it puddled your garden. And if it puddled your garden, you're ready to give up the ghost and say I should have planted some rice there. It would have grown a lot better in that flooded soil.
Or something with tap roots,
yes,
maybe, to
yeah.
manage.
But anyway, I just visited a garden that I planted in South Fargo and the day after Memorial Day, a very, very hot day. And we watered them immediately, the plants that we put in immediately right after putting them in. And we watered them twice a day, and once in the morning and once in the evening, going into the evening hours. And then we got that 1 1/3 inch rainfall, 1.3 inches of rainfall coming down pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
Went out there 2 days ago to see how it was doing, and it was flooded. My tomato plants were underwater. My pumpkins were underwater. My cabbage was underwater. And I'm thinking, oh, man, dead. Well, I went out there this morning. Bingo. Everything is up and thriving as if, well, thank you for that nice drink of water. Now we have somewhere to go if we can follow
maybe
that.
Maybe their roots went a little deeper?
Yes. Okay. They're doing much, much better. So I think we're going to have a garden to show off somewhat out there.
Well, excellent.
Survival of the fittest anyway.
That is how nature works.
Yeah.
You know, talking about flooding, though, and flood management, the guest on the first half of the show, Beth Dooley, is out with a cookbook, and she is talking in that cookbook about things like kernza, which would be an alternative to the wheat as we know it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantage of something like that being that it has those really long roots mm-hmm. that can manage a large amount of water, like a flood. They can manage drought a little better because they have those deeper roots.
Yeah.
They can
mm-hmm.
hold the soil in place better
mm-hmm. right.
And keep erosion in check. And she's watching things like that from a culinary point mm-hmm. of view because mm-hmm. it's also something that tastes
right.
very good.
Right.
I'm wondering, as a longtime horticulturist mm-hmm. who has done some consulting kinds of work, have you seen a trend with cities, with big businesses, or even homeowners, mm-hmm. are people starting to move more in that direction? Not kernza in their yard, of course, but the understanding an advantage to a deeper-rooted plant than a shallow-rooted plant.
Absolutely, and they're understanding also what the natural ecosystem will support. So you're not coming in there and doing a monoculture like they do in agriculture, just sections of wheat, oats, barley, corn, mm-hmm. whatever. So you go down a street now, and I happen to live in that type of a neighborhood where the ash trees are there. The emerald ash borer has not found it yet, mm-hmm. so we're doing fine. But some of the ash trees look pretty sad. So they take the ash trees out very well, very good, and they plant with a mixed species. There's going to be elms. There's going to be honey locusts. There's going to be lindens. Maples mm-hmm. as well. So in the future, people that move into where I'm living mm-hmm. now are going to be seeing a varied ecosystem
right.
of trees growing along the boulevard, which will be a much better ecosystem because if you happen to find one that's not going to make it because of a disease or mm-hmm. weather conditions or an insect like the ash borer,
mm-hmm.
You can say, well, we're only going to lose one tree out of these 100 trees that we have planted here because the next whatever tree that's being attacked is a half a mile or a mile away. We don't have mm-hmm. to go ahead and wipe out a whole block because we had the elm trees killed by the Dutch elm disease. Thank you very much. Young mind comes up with the answer there for me, and I appreciate it. Anyway, yeah, so that's the nice thing I'm seeing with forestry mm-hmm. and city parks and planters coming up with different things to go ahead and plant that are known to be hardy here, have slightly different growing conditions, rather than having something, well, we know elms will look good mm-hmm. here or ashes will look good here, and so we plant. And it does look good. It looks, from an architectural standpoint, from a beauty standpoint, it's fantastic. But from an ecological standpoint, mm-hmm. it's a potential disaster, just like playing with a loaded gun.
So that answer was all about trees. What
yeah.
about plants or even grasses? Have you seen anything?
Yeah.
You go to some states and the highway medians aren't grass at all. They're plants.
Yes.
Or
yes.
sometimes
kind of a ground cover.
A native ground
yeah,
cover.
Yeah, there are some good ground covers out there that you can go ahead and put in that are drought tolerant. From a homeowner standpoint, the ajuga is an excellent one that seems to kind of lay flat and then like it's not going to get established. And then all of a sudden the following spring comes around like, my God, I thought those were dead.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't dead. They're coming back and they spread and they hold on very well. Even through a drought, they hold on very, very well. So that's an example of one. Then you have sweet woodruff, which is another good ground cover that spreads very nicely and has white flowers and can go ahead and sequester any weeds that might be coming up, and also tolerate droughty conditions very nicely. Okay. So,
we're visiting today with horticulturist Ron Smith, and you can always send a question to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And Ron, you've said the word drought a couple of times, including at the beginning that the predictions are that it will be a hotter and drier summer mm-hmm. than normal. Are there any plants or just any tips of like, all right, don't worry about that this year? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, would you tell a gardener to just, oh, don't bother with tomatoes this year?
No.
Or not tomatoes, but is there anything, I guess, is the question. Or just like,
well,
let the lawn be green. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, your lawn can go into dormancy and not die. There's a big difference between dormancy and death.
Mm-hmm.
Dormancy too long is like holding your breath too long. It will eventually kill you. So it's the same thing with dormancy in turf grass. If we go 6 weeks without any rain, no big deal. We go 12 weeks without any rain, it starts to become a big deal, and your grass that's there might die. What you'll see coming up will be these stubborn weeds that don't need any encouragement at all because the grass is non-competitive now. And once the weeds start invading a dormant lawn, then you know you've gone too far between your irrigations or your waterings.
Okay.
The other thing I want to have people keep in mind is that if they have an automatic irrigation system or if they're watering, try to water with the idea in mind that you're watering as much for the trees and the shrubs on your property, especially your trees, rather than your lawn. Because if the lawn dies, it's no big deal to take it out. Go in there with a sod cutter, cut it out, and put in some sod or have it reseeded through the dead grass.
Right.
A tree that you've had there for 35, 40 years, even 10 or 15 years, is irreplaceable. You can't go out and buy a tree that's 15 years old, like the one you just lost, and stick it in there. It's just not going to work.
So what are some of the earliest signs of the most common trees around here that we need to be watering the trees better?
Birches, number one.
Okay.
They are very sensitive to dryness in their root system. And unfortunately, Americans all over love birches in the middle of their lawn. They take, especially a weeping birch, because they take the place of a weeping willow, which is an awfully messy tree. And it's kind of overrated for its beauty. It's beautiful along golf courses, and where they have ponds on golf courses, you can have them along areas like that. But on home lawns, don't go for willows. Go for something other than a birch in the middle of your lawn. If you want to put a birch there, whether it be a pinnacle birch or a spreading birch, weeping birch, make sure you put it in a bed around the base of the plant. Don't just stick it in the sod,
okay,
and then leave it, you know, 2 or 3 inches around it to go ahead and mow it. It needs to have cool, moist roots. The birch does. If it doesn't, it's going to defoliate, and there have been a lot of dying and dead birch trees around the state because of the dry soil conditions that we've had.
Hmm.
And so once they're dead, that's it. Once they've lost their leaves, you can't bring them back, and you have to go ahead and remove them. And it's sad. You know, I'm emotionally attached to my birch.
Yeah.
You know, and when I planted it back in 1985, I was told by my predecessor that was a stupid tree to plant. They don't last more than 5 or 6 years here. Well, fortunately, that person is now long since deceased. but I'm sure if he was still here, I'd say, when is this going to die? You know, I don't want to brag too much because, you know, a fickle finger of fate can hit you.
Well, that happens.
Yeah.
How about the impacts of that big heat wave that we got right after Memorial Day?
That heat?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that very well.
Yeah, I loved it.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're a heat lover.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't go inside for like 4 days.
You didn't?
No.
No wonder you have such good color. Okay. I was wondering. Anyway, it can be a killer heat to not only the plants but also to humans. And if you're going to be planting in heat, high temperatures like that, have water immediately available.
Okay.
And if you possibly can, if you're going to be planting trees and shrubs this summer in the middle of 90-degree temperatures, what we used to do in Saudi Arabia and Texas, dig the hole that you're going to plant it in, then fill the hole with water, let it drain down, and then put your tree or shrub in that hole, and then water it in again. And then the roots will follow the flow of the water. The roots will not go into dry soil. They hit that dry soil, I stop growing.
Know what to do.
But if you have pre-moistened that soil in that planting hole and you put the shrub or the ball of the shrub or the tree in that planting hole and then water it again afterwards immediately, then you're going to be off to a very, very good start getting it established successfully and not having it die out on you.
That's genius.
Yeah, well, yeah. Genius but practical.
That's the best kind of genius.
Yes.
I went out to Buffalo River State Park a couple of weeks ago and was just going on a nice walk along the river, and it absolutely sounded like it was raining. There were so many caterpillars
coming down. Yes, yes.
And it was, if you stopped for 3 seconds, you had 10 caterpillars on you.
Yeah.
And you couldn't at some point not step on one.
Yeah.
What other kinds of insects are showing up right now, and do we need to be worried about some of them?
Well, caterpillars gross people out. You have tent caterpillar. You have the forest tent caterpillar. You have the spring tent caterpillar. You have the fall caterpillar, tent caterpillar. Even though they're all called tent caterpillars, they aren't. They all don't build tents. For example, if you were walking through the woods and you were getting rained on by these caterpillars, that was probably, and I'm just making a guess, probably the forest tent caterpillar. And what they do is they swarm on tree trunks and tree branches, and they kind of, if the gravity takes hold, they kind of fall off. They don't hang on very well, and it's kind of a gross experience. And everybody panics. Is it going to kill the trees? Probably not. If you're talking about mature trees that have been established, yeah, they're going to go through a shock. But Mother Nature, in her wisdom, knows that there's going to be trials and tribulations for the plant species there. So even though this flush of growth that we've had coming out from these trees looks good, and the insects come along, whether they're aphids sucking the juice out or thrips doing the same thing whatever, your caterpillars, once those are picked out, you're going to get a second flush of growth of new leaves, not as robust as they were the first time, but it's enough to keep the tree alive.
Okay.
Now, if that repeats year after year after maybe the second or third year, then it's going to be a problem for their survival because they need that leaf canopy nice and thick and dense and lush to go ahead and make the carbohydrates from photosynthesis. So,
okay. What other kinds of things should we be doing in the lawns and gardens right now?
Mowing your lawn high, you know, with the way the temperatures came in for the lawn, people were smartly mowing their lawn high, thank goodness. But one of the things that I found that was interesting, Ashley, was you can have a nice green lawn with your irrigation system, but you'll have this burnt out corner. And you go over and you take a look at it. Why is that burnt out? Well, there's no disease there. There's no insect there. You kind of pick around, look at it, and everything else. And what you find is that there's something anomalously wrong with the soil there. Either it would too much fertilizer was spilled there, or maybe some gasoline was spilled there, or maybe it was just didn't get wet. It couldn't absorb the water. And the spots that I've seen that were showing up on the lawns with that rain that we had, that's the blessing that took care of a lot of those little random dead spots that you saw on your lawn. You're like, why is that dead over there? I don't have a dog. I didn't do anything special over there. It just turned out to be brown. Why do I have a brown patch in my lawn the size of a clipboard?
Mm.
There's no disease, no insects that are found there. So that's the only thing it can be, and it'll recover. If you want to encourage it, sprinkle a little bit of grass seed down there, a good grass seed mixture of about a third, a third, a third of Kentucky Blue, perennial ryegrass, and creeping red fescue. One of those three or all three will take hold and be a permanent part of that particular plant.
Okay. Do we need to worry about overspray, like if you have done some pre-emergent herbicide or anything like that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. The herbicides that are used to control pre-emergent weeds and post-emergent weeds are usually a combination of three different herbicides. And the ones that are most effective also have a tendency to be somewhat volatile. And so if you're going to be buying or using that, whether it's the salt spray or a volatile spray, You need to make sure that you do it on a windless day, not even a breeze.
Good luck in North Dakota. Yeah,
good luck in North Dakota.
And then you got to do it at 4 in the morning, probably.
Yeah, probably. Or at least give yourself a 3-foot barrier between the edge of the planting and where you're going to go. Don't go right up to the edge of the plant or of the bed, because what you'll do is you'll get some esters, some fumes coming from that. And on the recently opened foliage, you can get this epinastic fit that the leaves go through. That looks like
epinastic.
Epinastic. It's a real word. You can look it up.
Okay.
what it is, it looks like the leaves and the stems have been put into an egg beater, and so they're all kind of scrambled up.
Oh wow. Okay.
And that's detrimental to the plant. It's injuring the plant. It's a growth regulator type of an herbicide, and so it's stimulating it to grow in an irrational way. Excuse the humanistic term. It overstimulates it, and it causes it to go ahead and either decline or die, depending on what plant species happens to be.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And it's also irritating.
But also terrifying, yeah.
The people would have just put in some fresh shrubbery and see this happen if they've done it themselves. And, of course, if the lawn care operator comes around and puts this material down, then it's his or her fault for doing something like that, and he's got to do something about
it. Okay. So look for that sort of irrational growth on nearby plants. Is there anything else, like it might be gray or have some holes or brown or something?
No. It's just going to look very twisted. It looks like you've taken an egg beater, the best way I can describe it, or a teenager's hair that hasn't been combed or brushed in a long time.
So we want a windless day to be putting down any weed killer, if at all. But also this wind has been having a major impact on topsoil. We got a photo from the Lemoore County Soil Conservation District that has 25 truckloads of topsoil that had just blown in to a rest area.
Yes. Yep. And that's a shame, because that kind of reignites the memories of the real old people, even people older than me, about the Dust Bowl days. And that's how the Dust Bowls got started, with dryness. The soil then becomes very, very granular and almost dust-like. Mm-hmm. And it gets picked up by the wind, and it gets carried, and it got carried as far in the Dust Bowl days, all the way out to the East Coast. They were having the effects of that. You could look up and you see the sky covered with carrying that dust.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, it's not just that it's messy, but the topsoil is actually the only part you can plant in, right?
Yes. There's topsoil and then there's subsoil.
Yeah.
And subsoil is very, very difficult to grow in.
Yeah.
Impossible to grow in some ways, because it's not known to have good characteristics for growth, such as good pore space. Topsoil has a balance prescribed by Mother Nature of sand, silt, clay, and organic matter. So the three basic components that make up soil, plus about 3 to 5% organic matter in that soil, will make a wonderful medium to go ahead and grow agricultural crops and horticultural crops, and even your lawn, trees, and shrubs that you want to grow in your yard. I told my wife when we first moved here that when we were digging around on our property, that this topsoil was so fantastic that if I ever lost my job, I could dig all the topsoil out of my backyard and sell it, because it was so good. And it's rewarded us with good gardening results.
It is really
in our
important
backyard. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ron. Ron Smith joins us periodically during the growing season. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine. For more than 40 years, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Information on Facebook and www.ndhorizons.com.
From the 1940s onward, legendary black DJs created unique, ear-catching styles. I'm Jack Gales Webb. Join me for Hour 3 of the 25th Anniversary Edition of Black Radio Telling It Like It Was from PRX and the Smithsonian, honoring Black Radio's role in African-American history and culture.
Black Radio Telling It Like It Was, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 15th. It was on this date in 2005 that Phil Jackson was rehired as head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, continuing his remarkable career that took him from North Dakota to the Basketball Hall of Fame. Today, we bring you part one of his story. Phil Jackson was born in Deer Lodge, Montana, in 1945, but grew up in Williston, where he was a standout basketball player nicknamed Bones. He then went to UND, where his unusual left-handed hook shot helped earn him consecutive All-American honors. During his senior year, he averaged more than 27 points per game. In 1967, the New York Knicks drafted Jackson in the second round. He rarely started, but was always the first Knick off the bench. He twice won the Sixth Man Trophy, and he played an important role in the Knicks' 1973 NBA championship. But Jackson's greatest talent emerged when he began coaching in various professional leagues, like the Continental Basketball Association, where he won his first coaching championship. He was named the CBA Coach of the Year in 1985. He regularly sought NBA jobs and finally caught on as an assistant with the Chicago Bulls. But his big break came on December 17, 1988, when the Bulls' high-strung coach was ejected early in the game. Jackson understood the value of every team member, not just the Bulls' superstars, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. The Bulls were trailing by 14 when assistant coach Jackson stepped in, tinkered with the defense, and told his players to just go out and play. Horace Grant, the Bulls' forward, later said, "It was like we were let out of a cage. We won the game because we were so relaxed, and we knew that Phil should become a head coach." The following summer, they got their wish. But it wasn't an automatic success story. Fortunately, Michael Jordan recognized Jackson's merits. Michael respected Phil, Grant said, and it just carried over to the team. As head coach for the Chicago Bulls, Jackson led the team to 6 national championships in 9 years. He took a year off, then joined the Lakers in 2000 and immediately guided them to the NBA championship. He was the first coach to lead 2 different teams to multiple NBA championships. Tune in tomorrow for part 2 of the Phil Jackson story. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with a veteran and a writer who is using his time and talents to help other trauma survivors use writing as a form of therapy. And it's been nearly 10 years since the flood of record in Minot. We are going to start our special series looking back on the flood of 2011. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.